Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the Court. Richard Calderoni from Mayor Brown for the petitioner appellant Thomas Herlow. The government does not dispute on this appeal that if this Court reaches the merits of Mr. Herlow's Section 2255 petition, then he is entitled to relief in the form of an evidentiary hearing. The substantial disputes between the parties instead concern two threshold issues. First, whether in order to show that his notice of appeal was timely filed, Mr. Herlow had to prove that his prison lacked a separate legal mailing system within the meaning of Federal Rule of Appellate Procedure 4C, and second, whether the waiver of collateral challenge rights in Mr. Herlow's plea agreement bars his claim that the plea agreement and his guilty plea resulted from the ineffective assistance of counsel. As to the notice of appeal, Rule 4C states that a prisoner's notice of appeal is considered filed when it's deposited in the institutional mailing system, and it's undisputed in this case that Mr. Herlow took that step well within the 60-day period for filing the notice. The rule then sets out two procedural requirements that operate in the alternative, and it's also undisputed that Mr. Herlow has satisfied the second of those requirements by providing this Court with a declaration under penalty of perjury stating the date that he mailed the notice of appeal and attesting to the fact that he prepaid first-class postage.
The government he didn't say first-class, though, right?
Not in the initial declaration, Your Honor, although he did at that point say that his conversation with the mailroom staff was about the procedures for mailing things first-class.
Are there any other kinds of classes that an individual can mail something?
I suppose one could mail something certified or return receipt or, you know, if you have a book, you can mail it media mail. Obviously, that wasn't going to be at issue here. But I would also note that Mr. Herlow provided a supplemental declaration with his opening brief that expressly states that it was first-class postage prepaid. So there's no further question. The government doesn't dispute at this point that he satisfied that requirement. Instead, the government bases its argument on the first of the two alternative procedural requirements, which is that prisoners in institutions with separate legal mailing systems must utilize those systems. The government, however,
what's the record in this case about the existence of a system designed for legal mail at Mr. Herlow's institution?
Your Honor, the only evidence concerning that topic is in Mr. Herlow's jurisdictional memoranda and declarations, and it indicates that there was no such system because the individuals staffing the mailroom at his institution told him quite clearly that he could either hand his envelope containing the notice of appeal to them or place it in the institutional mailbox. Either was just as efficient, and no matter which step he took, it would be considered as delivered to the court the moment he took that step.
And the letter had the court's address on it. Actually, the wrong court, but a court address on it.
Yes, it had this court's address on it, Your Honor. That's correct.
So there was no question that the mailroom people could have been under some misapprehension that it was a personal letter to his mother or something.
Right, absolutely. And he also made quite clear that his conversation with him was about the prisoner mailbox rule, which would not in any way apply to a personal letter to his mother or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
But the government's argument is essentially that Mr. Herlow had to provide this kind of evidence or even more evidence that there was no legal mailing system at his institution, and that argument can't be squared with the text of Rule 4C, because the rule says Mr. Herlow's burden here is only to show timeliness, and the rule clearly says that timely filing may be shown by providing the declaration he provided that includes two facts, neither of which has anything to do with a separate legal mailing system. So we submit that it's the government that bears the burden on this issue and not Mr. Herlow, and that for the reason you said, Judge Wood, Mr. Herlow has satisfied that burden even if he bears it in this case.
Okay, so what about the second of these hurdles, which is his ability to overcome the collateral attack waiver?
Certainly, Your Honor. The government does not dispute that Mr. Herlow's claim that his counsel was ineffective would, if successful, result in the invalidation of his plea agreement. And that
he's perfectly willing. He's not trying to save part of the plea agreement and get rid of part of it. He understands the whole thing goes.
Absolutely. In fact, if you look at page 80 of the separate appendix, Your Honor, which is in his submissions to the district court in this case, he says quite clearly that he wishes to rescind the plea agreement on the basis of ineffective assistance.
There is some real risk to that. He could lose his acceptance of responsibility if he's not believed at the suppression hearing. He could gain instruction. He had a below-guideline sentence, didn't he?
Yes, he did, Your Honor, because the prosecution did not correctly calculate the guidelines range.
And it was a binding sentence, so he gives all that up.
He's willing to, Your Honor, yes, because as the record in this case shows at this point, it's pretty clear that there was a Fourth Amendment violation, and if there was a Fourth Amendment violation, there's no evidence against Mr. Herlow.
Well, the latter part of that is certainly true, but there are some other potential witnesses at that suppression hearing that he desires that might have a different view on it.
I suppose they might, Your Honor. There's nothing at all in the record to suggest that they would. But because his claim would have...
Well, there is, though. There is a signed consent by the wife, and there's the presentation at the guilty plea hearing, now wife, I should say, that she consented to the release, to the search.
There is that signed consent form, Your Honor, but that consent form has nothing to do with the issue under Georgia versus Randolph of whether that consent was valid as to Mr. Herlow, who was present and objecting at the time. And in addition, if that consent was secured by the threat that the police would remove her children from the home if she did not consent to the search, then the consent form, as the Ninth Circuit held in the Hatley case, should not and would not validate the search.
Don't we have to presume that what he said at the guilty plea hearing was true? Don't we start with that?
That is a general presumption, Your Honor, but those statements at the guilty plea hearing don't go to the waiver issue. The question at waiver is only, would the claim of ineffective assistance result in invalidation of the plea agreement if successful? If the answer to that question is yes, then the waiver isn't a bar. Those questions go, if at all, to the merits of this case. And this Court's decisions, particularly the opinion in Hutchings, make clear that those statements at the plea hearing or other statements in the record are going to undermine the merits of a case of an ineffective assistance of counsel claim under Strickland only when the statements at the plea hearing or in the record go directly and specifically to the claims at issue. And there is nothing at the plea hearing that should have put Mr. Herlow on notice that the search of his home was actually a violation of the Fourth Amendment. If there are no further questions at this time, I would like to...
Save your time.
Thank you.
Mr. Bont, good afternoon, it appears.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the Court and Counsel, Jonathan Bont for the United States of America. The Court should dismiss this appeal at the outset because the appellant did not file a timely notice of appeal.
You know, I have a problem with the way the government has been doing this. Since Mr. Herlow did say that he deposited this in the internal mail system, he says there's no special legal mail system. I disagree with the government that a comment about certified mail equals a comment about a legal mail system, since those are clearly two different things, and you can have certified mail without facility logs. And it's actually shocking to me, unless you can correct me if I'm wrong, that the government appears to have made no effort to find out if FCI Williamsburg had a legal mail system at the time. There's not a scrap of evidence in this record from the government.
Respectfully, Your Honor, the certified mailing, the government isn't suggesting, and I'm sorry if there was confusion on this issue, the government isn't suggesting that certified mailing is part of the requirement of a legal mail system.
But you said that Mr. Herlow conceded that there was a legal mail system, and all Mr. Herlow said in the language that you point to is that it was possible to mail things by certified mail. He never said there is a legal mailing system. What he recounts is that he talked to the prison mailroom people, and they said you can mail this letter either way you want. You can come over here to us, or you can put it in the box that's on your unit, and either one will do. So that's not a concession that there's a legal mail system.
Actually, Your Honor, his statement goes a little bit farther than just saying there's a system to send a letter certified mailing and return receipt requested. His statement says that the mailroom staff will document when that occurred and to whom it was sent to.
But that doesn't say it's legal mail or sending something out with regard to, you know, buying your house or, I mean, people send certified mail for all sorts of reasons, and maybe it's logged in. I just really don't think that any concession is going to save you here.
Respectfully, with that, Your Honor, I'd move on to the second point.
That would be fine. And on the second point, again, he makes an assertion. He describes what he's told, which is direct evidence. That's what he's told. I don't understand why the government didn't resolve this issue once and for all. You could have found somebody to swear out an affidavit from FCI Williamsburg about what kind of mailing systems they had there at the time. It was entirely within your ability to resolve this. Then we'd still have a question about what are the consequences if he's been told that he didn't need to use the system. There might be estoppels, there might be other kinds of things, but you didn't do anything.
I believe part of that stems from the procedural nature of the case, where generally, if there's an issue of untimeliness in the notice of appeal, that would be resolved on the record in the district court. And in this case, the appellant filed his notice of appeal in the Court of Appeals, and the Court of Appeals
just gets sent back to the district court and it gets refiled. That happens all the time.
Absolutely, Your Honor. But this court notified the district court that the appeal had been docketed and that the issue would be addressed by the appellant. When the appellant did that, he made the statement that suggested that there was a legal mail system. So the government position is, once he's made that statement suggesting that there is a separate mail system of some sort that documents when mailing was received, that then when the government calls the appellant on that, he must come forward with an affirmation saying that.
I can't find the words legal mail system in what he said.
Well, the courts that have interpreted what a legal mail system is essentially require only that it has a log of when mail is received and to whom it is sent to. And that's
a secret legal mail system. There has to be some communication to the prisoner that if you are sending legal mail, this is the way you have to do it. It can't be just the cognoscenti that wind up using this. And he may know that there is certified mail, but if he's not told by the prison mail staff you have to use this particular set of procedures, I don't see anything in Rule 4C that says whether or not he knows it exists.
No, Your Honor, and candidly, there is no record of that.
No, there isn't. What there's a record of is he's told what he did was enough, and he's way in advance of time. It's a 60-day period because it's a 2255, and he's taking all these steps around day 30, give or take.
Under the assumption that that is truthful, and yes, Your Honor, yeah, that he has made that mailing. Moving to the substantive issue, if I might, Your Honor, the waiver of his collateral challenge rights and how that affects his ability to even allege a 2255 claim in this case. The court has held in Jones and again in Mason that once a defendant has signed a plea agreement that waives his right to collaterally challenge his conviction or sentence, there's only two ineffective claims that can survive. One, that can the petitioner establish that his waiver wasn't knowingly or voluntarily entered into?
And it's very common in plea waivers, not in this in plea agreements, although I agree not in this one, that it's spelled out that one of the ways that the whole thing goes out the window, including the waiver of appeal and the waiver of collateral attack, is if it's the product of ineffective assistance of counsel.
Ineffective assistance with respect to the negotiation of the waiver.
No, actually, it's not. There are plenty of cases that don't limit it just to that one paragraph.
Well, Your Honor, the language that this court has used in previous cases implicate that it has to go to the effectiveness of counsel in negotiating the waiver. And here, appellant hasn't made any argument that goes to the negotiation of the waiver. He hasn't said so much that he wanted his counsel to preserve his appellate rights or his collateral challenge rights with respect to any one issue, and his counsel failed to do so.
So Jones says the right to appeal survives where the agreement is involuntary. Henderson, whenever the plea agreement generally was tainted by ineffective assistance of counsel. Bridgman is out there. There are plenty of cases that are looking at the entire agreement.
Looking at the entire agreement, and here that first avenue of potential relief under 2255 isn't available to the appellant because on the record at his plea hearing, he was questioned by the district court judge.
I don't think you're focusing on it right.
Well, he answered that he knowingly and voluntarily was waiving his right to his appeal.
Every single one of these cases where you come along, that's why you need a collateral proceeding to show that there was ineffective assistance of counsel. It's usually not there on the record.
And this court has held that it's a very narrow exception when that can take place.
It's not that easy to show, but it's...
And he hasn't made an argument that would survive that waiver. He hasn't alleged that his counsel failed in some way in the negotiation of the plea negotiation waiver.
He's saying counsel completely, you know, by saying plead guilty and enter into this agreement, ignoring the Randolph issue and the coercion issues, counsel from the very start was ineffective. Comprehensive ineffectiveness.
I agree, but
the whole thing.
I agree that's the argument that he's making, but that isn't an argument that's available on a 2255 motion where there has been a waiver of collateral challenge rights. It has to go to the waiver.
Maybe you're describing the issue. I think that's a question.
Well, and I believe that if appellant's argument were to be accepted, there's no limit to the amount of potential arguments that one could raise on a 2255 petition, notwithstanding the fact that there's a collateral challenge waiver.
It would have to be ineffective. I mean, if you look at every single plea agreement out of the Northern District of Illinois that includes an appeal and collateral attack waiver, they all say, except if the sentence is illegal, you know, we sentence only Latinos or something,
sure,
or if an ineffectiveness of counsel is being raised with respect to the negotiation of the plea agreement.
Not only the plea agreement, but the waiver.
No, that's not what they say, actually. Okay. So.
Well, with respect to the negotiation of the plea agreement, generally there's two arguments that have been recognized, notwithstanding a waiver, where waiver isn't an issue. And that's basically the standard that has to be set forth, is that counsel didn't investigate the facts of the case and attempt to make a good faith prediction of the likely sentence. And that's also not an issue that's being raised in this court today.
No, it's not a sentencing issue. It's I never should have entered into a plea agreement because you never told me that I had a dead bang winner on the merits.
And respectfully, Your Honor, the appellant waived that argument when he entered into the binding plea agreement, waiving his that with a waiver provision that waived his collateral challenge rights. And for that reason, the government should be, the district court's decision should be affirmed.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Anything further, Mr. Calderone?
On the waiver point, I would just note that Jones, the very case on the government relies, held that a completely naked assertion of ineffective assistance of counsel, simply, I entered into the plea agreement because of ineffective assistance and it was involuntary, was not waived by a waiver of collateral challenge rights in the plea agreement. The court reached the merits of that claim. And if the court's going to reach the merits of that claim, it follows that the court should reach the merits of this claim, too. Unless there are further questions, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. And thank you also to you and your firm for taking the case. We appreciate your assistance.